From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, novelist John Lesquois, magazine publisher Winnie Comstock Carlson, and folk rock musician Richard Thompson. But first, a new interactive map shows the best and the most harmful places in West Sacramento from a youth point of view. The goal is to empower young people and help guide city leaders when they design spaces. We're going to start our discussion with one of the young people who created the map. He's Juan Oquendo, a 16-year-old at River City High School in West Sacramento. He's one of the early members of the West Sacramento Youth Resource Coalition, which created the map. Juan, welcome to Insight.
Hello. How are you doing?
Where did the idea for the map come from?
It came from the very beginning. We all thought about places that weren't very healthy for us youth to hang out. And so we kind of named some places that we thought weren't very healthy. Then we kind of started to do something about it, like we started to do beautification projects. We done beautification projects first to make them look good.
Who or what motivated you all to do this, to take this initiative?
Oh, this was just all on us. We kind of just decided, we took it up with our adult leaders first, and they said, yeah, you guys can do it long as you know what you're doing, and you can get people to back you up on what's going on.
Now, when you say places that are not healthy, could you give us an example or two?
I'd say like a place that has that hasn't been cleaned up in a while, like trash everywhere, graffiti on the walls, just really, really nasty.
Give people an idea of what this map looks like.
Basically, it's a layout of the West Sacramento, and then we have balloons, or we'll have like a little color symbols on the end to signify whether this place is a safe place, unsafe place, or it's a healthy place, or in a very unhealthy place for a child or youth to hang out.
And who decides what's healthy and unhealthy, and are there ever disagreements among you all about what should be on the map?
There's a lot of disagreements and all that, but we always come through it. And what was the other question?
Are there disagreements? And who decides, and are there disagreements?
We all decide. We can't just leave the deciding up to one person, because then that'd be unfair.
Yeah. So we're talking about the West Sacramento Youth Resource Coalition and the interactive map that they've created. One of those young people, Juan Oquendo, is in our studio. He's a 16-year-old at River City High School. In our studio with us is Matt Cervantes, who's program officer of the Sierra Health Foundation, which financially supports the West Sacramento Youth Resource Coalition. Matt, welcome.
Thank you.
How did the Sierra Health Foundation get involved with Juan and his friends?
Well, we are the funder, and the project that Juan described earlier is a piece of our Healthy Youth, Healthy Regions study in this region, in the Sacramento region. So this is one piece of this larger initiative within the Sacramento region.
Juan explained that he and his friends had been getting together informally to try and make things better. The Sierra Health Foundation is a big foundation. How do we know that what Juan and his friends are doing is what they really want to do and not just part of a big agenda at the Sierra Health Foundation?
Sure, because we're a strong believer in youth voice, and we really listen closely to what they say. So we are not the type of institution or funder that sort of heavy-handed comes down and dictates what they need to present to us. We give them the tools and resources, access to these resources, but it's really their youth voice that is expressed through this youth map.
What kind of tools and resources?
Support. They have a youth coordinator. They're partnered with UC Davis researchers as part of the Healthy Youth, Healthy Region study. And then, so those types of resources and support.
Well, speaking of UC Davis researchers, one of them joins us too by phone, Patsy Eubanks-Owens, who's Associate Professor of Landscape Architecture. Patsy, welcome.
Thank you.
What does landscape architecture have to do with an interactive map about good and bad places in West Sacramento?
Right. Well, one thing that we're interested in is trying to understand how the physical environment affects people's lives. And so we've been really concerned as far as understanding the youth environment from the youth perspective, so what the youth think about the place where they live and what that means to them. And so, as Matt said, this is all part of the Healthy Youth, Healthy Regions project. And what that project's trying to do is document the conditions, the existing conditions in the region, and how they relate to youth well-being and regional prosperity. And this piece of the project, the Youth Voices for Change, is really trying to get that youth perspective instead of just relying on other, you know, other kind of information.
Why? What would be the benefit for, I guess, local leaders, government leaders, and so on, in hearing from young people in this way?
Well, the young people are the ones who are actually on the ground. They're the ones that are actually going to these places, and the decisions that are made are the ones that affect their lives on a day-to-day basis. I can give you one example. They have a really great teen center in West Sacramento, the Collings Teen Center, and it's a great support for the youth, but it closes during the summer. There's no funding to keep it open. And so that's one thing that Juan and the other Sactown Heroes have said, you know, we really want the teen center to be open in the summer. That's, you know, we really need it then because we don't have anything else to do.
And what do you and others at UC Davis do specifically to help the young people create this map and the other projects they're working on?
We've been meeting with them since March on a weekly basis and going through lots of discussions. You know, like Juan was talking about, there's a lot of, you know, disagreement sometimes, so helping them talk through it and talk about what the different issues are and why some people like the skate park and some people don't like the skate park, or, you know, other different places in the community. And so we've been going through them, you know, with them through those discussions. We also, during their spring break, the youth in West Sac gave up their spring break and actually came to UC Davis and worked on campus here with us and learned all the technology, learned how to use the computer programs and how to create their own videos and do photography and upload all their information onto the website.
Juan, what's it been like specifically for you and others in the West Sacramento Youth Resource Coalition to work with the people at UC Davis and Sierra Health Foundation? Because obviously they're bringing a lot to the table, expertise, money, equipment, mm-hmm. and so on. But I'm guessing you all really want to make sure that this remains real and pertinent to what you're all doing.
Well, it's really fun working with them because they provide us with the equipment, and sometimes we can't provide all the equipment. So, and another thing is that it's just really great because I love meeting new people, and they taught us some things. Like, I'm really good with computers, but they taught me more things that I didn't know about. Some things on making videos and stuff. So, yeah.
Because there are photographs and videos attached to the places marked on the map.
Yeah, correct.
So you can actually see specifically. Mm-hmm. Have any people or organizations got in touch with you and said, hey, we shouldn't be on this map. There's nothing wrong with us.
No, not yet, and hopefully not. There shouldn't be.
Matt, is there a potential for controversy there for Sierra Health Foundation?
I don't think so. I think we're excited about the opportunity to have those discussions. If people need to kind of come together and start talking about maybe the issues that young people are raising in their community, I think that's healthy. I mean, if we do it in a respectful and tactful way, I don't think there's anything wrong with those discussions.
Can I provide
Please.
An example with that?
Please.
At one of the Youth Coalition meetings, we actually gave a little precursor to it, and we showed a slide of one of the community gardens that one of the youth had taken. And just showing that image generated a lot of discussion in that group about what to do with our community gardens. And some people were really positive, and some people were talking about all the problems that are associated with them. But it was like Matt said, it was just a great vehicle to get people to start talking about what the issues were.
Patsy, this has obvious benefits for the young people who are involved in making the map and people who look at the map, but what about people who actually design cities and spaces? It's pretty well known that a lot of places are specifically designed to be unattractive to teenagers, public spaces. How does this kind of work fit in with that, something that you commonly find in architecture and design?
And that's an area where most of my research has actually been focused. And the one of the problems that I found is most of the things that we do as far as designing teens and places is that we don't look at the place as far as where can we find a place for them. We always think about the negative behaviors of teens, how things are going to be misused. And so what we're hoping is a project that like this, is where people can actually listen to youth, is understand that they have some real legitimate concerns and they have some real legitimate need to be able to be in our public spaces. I think right now the way society views youth is if you see, you know, some youth walking down the sidewalk, you're thinking, okay, what trouble are they going to cause next? Instead of thinking, oh, this is great that they can get out and walk around and do things.
One?
Well, yeah, basically like what she said, like some people, like some, I don't know how to put this, some adults, they'll assume stuff rather than seeing, like they assume that what they like is what we're assumingly gonna like, but obviously we're not gonna like what they like because we like different things. Yeah. And they're kind of old.
Final word from you, Matt?
Well, I just say this is a real good opportunity, I think, to impact the communities that young people live in and show that young people are a resource to those communities and just need to be engaged in this process and the planning of cities. And, you know, I think if you listen to the young people, they have a lot of creative ideas on how their community should look and interact with them.
Well, we've been talking about an interactive map created by young people in West Sacramento, the West Sacramento Youth Resource Coalition, otherwise known as Sactown Heroes. And Juan Oquendo is a 16-year-old at River City High School, one of the early members of the coalition. Matt Cervantes is program officer of the Sierra Health Foundation, which funds their work. And Patsy Eubanks Owens is an associate professor at UC Davis, which has been working with the young people to help them in this process. And we will put a link to the map, if you're interested to see it, later on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. In the meantime, Patsy, Juan, Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, author John Lasqua and his new novel, his 20th. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Email us suggestions for future topics. Our address is insight@capradio.org. Best-selling novelist John Lasqua has a new legal thriller out. It's titled A Plague of Secrets, and it brings together his three most famous characters. Also around this time, Lasqua's first novel, out of print for many years, has just been reissued. John Lasqua joins us to talk about all this and more. John, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Good to be back.
How does it feel seeing 20 novels all written by you on your bookshelf?
It is shocking and unbelievable. I didn't think I would ever get to 20. It's just an amazing number. I wasn't even aware I was getting there until we were talking about publicity for this book, and my publicity person at Dutton said, you know, this is number 20. And I went, no, that's not possible. But here it is. So it's great.
Now, I mentioned earlier that that this book brings together your three best-known characters, Dismas Hardy, the attorney, Abe Glitzky, the detective, and Wyatt Hunt, private investigator. Wyatt Hunt emerged and evolved separately from Dismas and Abe. What gave you the idea to bring them together?
Well, I blame it all on my wife. She was... I had what I thought was a really good plot idea, and I thought I had a pretty nice theme going for this book when I first started it. And I told Lisa about the idea, and I said, but I don't know how to tell the story. There's so many threads to it. You know, I'd really like to figure out how to get, how to get this told in a kind of an efficient way. And Lisa said, you know, everybody likes all of your guys and girls. Why don't you put them all together and just put them on the page a lot? Yeah. And sure enough, once I started writing it, it seemed like the ideal way to tell the story, and I loved having these people all together.
My guest is the novelist John Lasqua. His latest book is A Plague of Secrets. Is it easier or harder to write a novel nowadays? Do you look forward to it as much or less than you used to?
That's a good question. There's a little more element of fear nowadays, I think, because the expectations are a little greater than they were when I began. But I always like doing it. It's a great job because, as you know, we've talked about this before. I've had all kinds of other jobs in my life and really didn't start making a living as a novelist until I was 45. So the idea of this being like hard work is not really in the picture for me. It's just something that I'm lucky that I get to do it.
So what is the element of fear then?
Well, the element of fear is the expectations are that the book is going to be, you know, of a certain length and a certain, you know, caliber. And you just start feeling once in a while, especially in the midpoint of a book, I'm going, you know, I've written 20 pretty good books, and I hope this one is as good as those. And that's the kind of thing you have to fight against. You just go, no, you just keep having fun with it and hope it turns out to be, you know, what it is.
Do you fight against it, or do you somehow tap into it to help inspire you?
I think a little both. The main thing I do is treat it as much as I can like a day job. I just come in every day and sit at my computer and go to work at 10 and turn it off at 5. Try not to think about it on the weekends too much. and just come in and do it again.
Yeah.
But you know, a 450-page book, that's just a lot of pages. I mean, even to somebody who's been, you know, lucky enough to be as prolific as I am, it gets to be a lot of pages, and you just go, wow, this is intimidating in some way.
Marijuana is an important element of the story in A Plague of Secrets, which is set in San Francisco. What gave you the idea to bring marijuana into the story?
Well, I think a little bit it's the whole, I got a little bit connected through my friends talking about, my friends in law enforcement, just talking about the dichotomy between how marijuana is viewed by, for example, the federal authority and by the local jurisdictions. And this became a kind of a big plot point in the book where a federal attorney, you know, to the feds, marijuana is illegal. That's the end of that story, and it's a very serious offense to have it. Whereas in San Francisco, in fact, in all of California, you know, marijuana is considered medically okay to buy. In fact, it's legal to buy. And also, it's a pretty benign recreational drug that a lot of people have used for a long time. And I just found that the conflicts between those two things would make for a pretty interesting story. And I think they did. Because a lot of what goes on in the book harkens back to when the characters were in college and carefree and nothing seemed to be too important. Well, you know, we all know what can happen if you're not paying attention. And sure enough, it did happen.
Sure.
Yeah.
I read that you keep up to date on legal matters with your old friend Al Giannini, who's a prosecuting attorney in the Bay Area. Tell us a bit about how you met Al and what you turned to him for.
Well, you know, we met in freshman English class in high school, and our very first interaction was really typical of the way we have been forever. We had a big discussion in our English class about whether you diagrammed sentences in your head before you spoke them. And Al said, yes, you do. I can see exactly what I'm going to do and how each sentence plays out. And I said, that's just ridiculous. And as it turns out, I sit down and I write these books, and I don't really know how they're going to turn out. And then I give it to Al, you know, when it's done, because he's my legal vetter, and he checks them over for the legal stuff. But then, of course, because of our longstanding friendship, he goes, you know, I don't think you thought this through before you started doing it. And, you know, we always get to an answer, and it's always, you know, very satisfying. It's a terrific relationship. We're best friends still for all these years.
Do you think after all these years that you buy it, that Al actually diagrams his sentences before he speaks?
I still think he's a little full of it on that one, you know. But he is a very, very intelligent guy. Don't play chess with him or poker. So he does do a little bit more forward thinking than I do, I think.
John Lesquoy's new novel is A Plague of Secrets. As we mentioned, one of the characters, as is so often the case with your books, is Dismas Hardy.
Uh-huh.
I'm curious to know why you named him after the thief who was crucified next to Christ.
Well, you know, I was raised a good Catholic boy, and I really wanted to have an interesting, different character. A name. I didn't want to have, like, Joe Smith or something like that. I wanted a character like Sherlock Holmes, who was a very distinctive name. And actually, Dismas came to me when I was in college. I wrote a kind of a prototypical novel, but it wasn't a legal thriller. I just wanted to see if I could write a book-length work. And one of the characters in there was named Dismas Hardy. And I said, that is a great name. I'm keeping that name no matter if I throw the rest of this thing away. And sure enough, about 20 years later, I sat down and started the first real Dismas Hardy novel. And I think it's also cool that St. Dismas, in the Catholic hierarchy, in the canon, is the patron saint of thieves and murderers. So, you know, it couldn't be better for a defense attorney, really. So it's a perfect name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, your first novel came out in 1982, and it's been out of print for most of the time since then.
Right.
But it's just been released in a new paperback edition. Why is it only just coming out again now after all these years?
You know, I think Dutton or New American Library, which is their paperback half, they just decided, you know, they've got all my other books. Why not come out with Sunburn? And then they can just say, you know, we've got them all. And it's amazing to me, Jeffrey, that this book is out. It's, you know, I still like the book very much, but it's, you know, it's very much a first novel. It's a, you know, it's a learning book for me as a writer. And I think it taught me a whole bunch of really good lessons, and I think it's a pretty good story. But it was fascinating to see it come out as a modern, you know, kind of mass market paperback, especially when it was done first. It was done as a very kind of low-end, really bad cover, really no marketing, and didn't do very well at all, which you could kind of predict. And this book is out now. It looks beautiful, and it's doing very well. So it's very interesting to me to think about the marketing of books and how it all plays and whether or not it really is all about the book or whether it's about the cover.
On your website, you describe that original bad cover as being semi-pornographic.
Yes. So would you. It is, I mean, the funny thing about that book is that, you know, it's a very small, kind of really crummy-looking book with two bare-chested guys and a bare-chested woman on the front, with everything cleverly hidden by arms and legs and this and that. And it's really terrible. But, you know, that copy of the book is a very rare book, and it's on, you know, they sell it on eBay for up to $600. It's crazy.
You also, on your website, have a sort of disclaimer for your fans, because it's not a legal thriller or a crime book, as you're famous for now. You describe it as a literary book.
Well, it's definitely a literary book. It had all kinds of experimental parts in it. The voice that I used in it varied by chapter, and that was on purpose. But I was, I was a young writer kind of finding his way, and I think it's really kind of a fun, good book. But I just wanted to tell my readers who are waiting for a Dismas Hardy book that they're not going to find Dismas in this book, nor are they going to find Abe. It's very much a Hemingway-type story. It's even set in Spain. So it's a, you know, it was the kind of book that just got me thinking, well, I can actually do this. And then when it won this award that it won for best novel by a California author, I finally felt that maybe I could actually do this for a living. So it was a real groundbreaking moment for me, that book.
And I read that you're working on a short story for a collection based on fishing. Are you a fisherman?
Just finished it. Have a really nice short story. I'm very proud of it, called Cutthroat. T. Jefferson Parker called me up two or three months ago and asked me if I wanted to be in this anthology, and he is one of my favorite writers in the world. So the idea of being in an anthology with Jeff Parker was a real draw for me, and so I finished the current book I was working on and sat down and wrote that in about a week. So,
are you a fisherman?
I am a fisherman. I just caught 10 fish last weekend up at Salmon Lake. I went up where my son is working up there and caught some fish. It was great.
10 fish.
10 fish.
And how long were they?
The smallest was about 6 inches, but I caught one real nice about 14-incher. It was a beauty.
Walking
and it was funny. I should tell you this because this is just a major event in my life. But I decided to use my fly rod the second day. The first day I was using bait fish, which I never do. But everybody was catching fish with power bait up there. So I did that, used power bait, and caught some fish and said, well, this is kind of fun. I wonder if I can put power bait on a fly and catch them like that. And sure enough, I, you know, had a tiny, tiny little fly hook, put on some power bait, and just whacked the lake the next day. Caught 5 more in about 20 minutes. I think I invented a new technique, power bait and fly fishing.
Oh, I'm impressed.
It was fun.
Finally, John, in an interview with Narrative Magazine, you said that you write throughout the school year. Why do you write throughout the school year?
Well, in the days that my children lived at home, it's because I wanted to have the same schedule as them so we could go on vacations in the summer.
But, of course, that doesn't apply.
It just turned out that I wound up having my contracts. I arranged it so that I handed in my outline for the next book in September, and they would usually accept that, and then I would then write the book through June. So it gave me the summers off. It was just perfect.
But your kids, of course, are well beyond that age now.
They are. They're gone. But I'm still in that. Well, actually, here it is about 1st of July tomorrow, right? And I'm still working on the next book. So I'm not exactly in my schedule now, but that's because they have me on an accelerated publishing pace, which I'm really think is kind of cool. I have 4 books out over, you know, this, I think, 14-month period. So
my goodness.
A busy time.
Well, just as well, you're such a good angler. So you don't need to spend too much time fishing.
No, not too much time.
John Lesquois, novelist, his latest book, A Plague of Secrets. It's his 20th novel. Also just out, his first novel, Sunburn. It was out of print for many years, just been released in a new paperback. John Lesquois is at the Borders in Davis tonight at 7, and tomorrow night at 7 at the Borders in Sacramento. John, thanks again for talking with us.
Fantastic, Jeffrey. See you again.
Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Local publisher Winnie Comstock Carlson. She's celebrating the 20th anniversary of Comstock's, the magazine she founded, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Look for Insight on Facebook. We're at Insight on Capital Public Radio. Tomorrow in Insight, topics include the new book Alcatraz, The Gangster Years. The famous prison opened on July 1st, 1934. A local magazine is celebrating its 20th anniversary at a time when many publications are struggling to stay afloat. What has Winnie Comstock Carlson learned over the years running Comstock's magazine? And what are her plans? She's in our studio. Winnie Comstock Carlson, welcome to Insight.
Well, thank you very much.
You started Comstock's in 1989 out of the failure of an earlier local business magazine called California Executive, and you worked for that magazine selling advertising. Why did you think Comstock's had a chance when its predecessor went under?
Different management, different philosophies, a desire to be more connected with the community. And really leading by, I have a very strong faith, and leading by the Lord really put the whole thing into my mind, and I knew it would be successful as a result of that.
So was it literally a leap of faith then?
It was a total leap of faith. And it would naturally be, if you start a company with no funding, a total bankroll of $2.50, it is a total leap of faith.
What do you mean a bankroll of $2.50? Literally?
Literally, yes. I couldn't, as a woman-owned business and a women business owner, I could not get the lending that I would have liked through a bank. And SBA would not loan to a media property, quote unquote. So I had to kind of do it on my own. So I had about $2.50 and a couple of empty credit cards, and I loaded them up.
You said that you had trouble getting a loan because you were a woman-owned business. I mean, 1989, it's not that long ago. It's just 20 years ago.
I think it was just as partially it was because I was a woman, I'm sure, but maybe more so because the magazine industry is such a risky one that it didn't seem like a really good investment opportunity for a bank.
And the publisher of California Executive actually went bankrupt, didn't he?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, so I guess...
But not because of the magazine, because of the real estate holdings that they were involved with at the time.
My guest is Winnie Comstock Carlson, publisher of Comstock's magazine. She founded it in 1989, and it celebrates its 20th anniversary in the upcoming July issue. Why did you decide to use your name for the magazine?
Well, when I got the vision in my dream for this magazine, I was looking at all of the regional business magazines in the country that were successful, and there was one that was highly successful. I considered it to be the kingpin of the industry at the time, and it was out of Washington, D.C., and it went by the name of Regardi's. And Regardi was the last name of the publisher, and that magazine was highly successful, and had been around at that point for a very long time. And then this vision, I actually didn't come up with the idea myself. I was sleeping peacefully one night, not knowing what I was going to be doing for a job after Executive closed. And 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and I just saw this vision, and it was a magazine with the name Comstock's on the top. And I was thinking, oh my word, what, I'm supposed to start a magazine? And by 9:30 the next morning, I'm on the Secretary of State's doorstep registering the name Comstock's Magazine and Comstock Publishing, and I'm off and running.
Now, you had been selling advertising before that for California
yes.
Executive.
And originally for Sacramento Magazine. I had already been in the business for 14 years, and it was because of those relationships that I was able to leverage enough advertising support to get a magazine off and running.
Well, I can imagine selling advertising successfully is a useful skill for a publisher, but what else did you need to learn?
I had to learn a lot of things along the way. I had to learn how to be a manager. I had to learn to delegate. I certainly had to be involved in much more than advertising sales. I had to connect with the community at every possible level, to get on boards, to get involved in all kinds of things, to have my ear to the ground constantly, my nose to the grindstone, and my shoulder to the wheel, which was kind of an interesting position to be in.
Back in 1991, you were in talks about buying the Sacramento Union newspaper. The paper later folded. How serious were those talks?
At the time, you know, that was a long time ago, but at the time I was very serious about it, and I felt that there was an opportunity to make that work again because of the fact that I always connected people and I got right into the middle of things, and I seemed to have a knack to be able to bring together the a cadre of very talented people. And that's one of the reasons I think that that the magazine has worked, is that bringing together the right people to make the product the best that it can be.
Given that the Sacramento Union eventually folded, and given the problems facing the Sacramento Bee and daily newspapers all over the place, with hindsight, are you glad you didn't buy it?
Oh, my word, yes. I believe the Lord really takes care of me. Yes, the newspaper business is not one I would want to be in right now.
For a couple of years in this decade, you had a local rival, Prosper Magazine, which was started in part by former employees of yours. They left Comstock's to start Prosper. Did you know that that's what they were going to do when they left?
No, no idea.
Was that a problem?
I'd have to say that it was troubling, but I really just decided that things were going to unfold the way they were supposed to, and I didn't really focus an awful lot on it, but I did change a lot of the things that we were doing because I knew that if I was having competition that was significant, that I needed to really focus on the main product. And at that point, we had started Comstock's in Northern Nevada. We'd published it for 9 years. We'd started Comstock's in San Joaquin Valley. We'd published it for 2 years. And I was about to launch Comstock's in Fresno when I thought, oh, my word, there's got to be something wrong here. I can't spread myself this thin and spread our resources out that thin and be able to deal with head-on competition, too. So I just dropped everything else we were doing and just put all the focus that I could into our magazine. We elevated the skill level of the staff. We changed our magazine, did a full redesign, and did a lot of things that really made it several notches better than what it had been before.
And Prosper went out of business. And around that time, the Sacramento Bee quoted you as saying that Prosper starting up turned out to be, quote, a blessing because it gave you a kick in the pants to get to the next level. You
That's
still stand
exactly.
by that?
Absolutely. Competition is really very good.
No doubt. Now, you have a bit of a wild side, scuba diving, skydiving. You've climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. You've even taken a ride in an F1 fighter jet.
Yes.
I guess running a magazine isn't exciting enough.
I think you need a little diversion.
Have you always done that kind of thing?
I think so, yes. I've always, I can't say I've been a thrill seeker, but I can say I've liked the adventurous side of things. I've been riding horses since I was a kid, used to love to do endurance riding and, you know, riding the fast rides and all of that. But as I've gotten older and I found a little bit of time and I realized that the time that is left is much shorter than the time that I've had, I have a lot of things that I just want to accomplish. There are other mountains that I'd like to climb. I have no desire to do anything as large as, let's say, Everest, but I would like to do Aconcagua, which is a mountain in Peru, in the highest peak in the Andes. And actually, last year I trained to climb it, and I was 8 months into the training. It takes about a year to train. I was 8 months into the training when the economy started getting a little bit squirrely, and I decided that there was no way that I could be gone for 3.5 weeks to climb a mountain.
Kilimanjaro is about 20,000 feet.
19,340. Uh-huh.
What's it like being at the top?
It is very cold, very windy, and basically, there were 10 what we'll call clients and 40 packers that went on this adventure. And all of the clients, when we got up to the top, just said, let's get the pictures taken and get the heck out of here. You know, there's very little air up there. It's very cold. It's windy. And you just want to get out of there. The thrill isn't so much the climb up. It's hard work. You know, you have to really concentrate on your breathing, and you have to really train long in advance. But once you get up there, it's like it's done. Get the pictures so that you have the proof that you did it, and go down, because the faster you go down, the better you're going to feel in terms of breathing and all of that.
I must say I was a little envious when I read that you'd taken a ride in an F1 fighter jet. That must be quite an experience.
It was an experience. It was very fortunate because, as it turned out, I was the last civilian to be able to ride in one of the jets before they mothballed the whole fleet. And they apparently let like two or three civilians take a ride in one of these jets a year. And the one before me was Mario Andretti. So it was Mario Andretti, then me, and then they mothballed the fleet. But it was an incredible experience. We were pushing 5 Gs and had to have the G suit on. And, you know, the blood was rushing up and down from your head into your toes. And there was a feeling of lightheadedness. They handed me a bag several times, and I just...
You threw up?
Well, I lost my cookies 5 times, and I just said to the pilot, no matter what happens, I want the full ride. We're not going down till we're done. So when I got off the plane, I literally was green. I almost had no awareness of where I was. It affected my mental awareness, I guess, in some ways. I don't recall how I drove home, but I remember that I slept over 20 hours afterwards. So being up there almost 2 hours and, you know, doing all of these maneuvers that were really stressing your body out, it was amazing to me how much that takes out of your system.
My goodness. Well, Winnie, Comstock's celebrating its 20th anniversary. A couple of years ago, the Sacramento Bee reported that you were possibly talking about selling the magazine to the current editor, Douglas Curley. Is that still true, or was it ever true?
Oh, I think there are probably a number of people in the community that might want to own the magazine, and that isn't anything that's happening.
So you're still firmly at the helm.
Firmly at the helm, although Doug is a very integral part of the magazine. He's the editor-in-chief. He does an exceptional job. And in fact, we just have a wonderful staff, and the magazine wouldn't be what it is today if it weren't for each and every one of them that contributes so much.
Winnie Comstock Carlson, publisher of Comstock's magazine. She founded the magazine in 1989. It celebrates its 20th anniversary in the upcoming July issue. Winnie, it was a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being here.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, folk rock guitarist and songwriter Richard Thompson. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's an Insight podcast. You can sign up at capradio.org/insight. One of the greatest guitarists and songwriters of folk rock is in town for a couple of concerts. Richard Thompson first became known in the late 60s as a member of the band Fairport Convention. He's still as busy as ever, recording new material and touring. Tonight's show in Sacramento is a regular solo concert. Tomorrow's is an all-request show. He joins us. Richard Thompson, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Well, as I said, your show tomorrow night is an all-request concert. With all the songs you've written over the years, how do you manage to keep them all performance ready?
Well, I don't. I remember as many as I can, you know, and sometimes someone will request something that I really just cannot remember, and I just have to fess up and say, well, you know, sorry, I try and keep it, you know, a couple of hundred in the front of my brain anyway.
A couple of hundred. Do you know how many you've written over the years?
Probably about 400.
I see. And do people ever ask you to play songs that are not yours at your request shows?
Oh, absolutely, yes. You know, sometimes from a genuine desire to hear that song, or sometimes just to try and trip me up, you know. So I get the bizarre requests from, you know, from... you know, Freebird, of course, is very, very popular. you know, things by the Kinks or the Beatles. I mean, you know, all kinds of stuff. Things from The Wizard of Oz. Extraordinary requests, some of which I'm not able to fulfill.
Well, you mentioned Freebird there jokingly, and one of the clips of your songs that we have lined up is Flee as a Bird. Let's listen to that and then talk about it.
Okay.
Now, as I recall in the credits, it says that's a traditional song arranged by you. Where does it come from?
That tune is, I think it's a hornpipe. And a hornpipe, you know, traditionally was a sailor's dance, but then it became a more generic kind of a 2/4 dance tune. Where that came from, I think I learned it out of a fairly obscure Victorian book of tunes.
My guest is the folk rock guitarist, singer, songwriter Richard Thompson. A lot of the music that you play nowadays, there's a folk flavor to it, but it's definitely rock. Did you start out when you were young just playing pure folk music?
Well, I started out listening to everything, really. You know, I grew up in London, and I had access to quite a lot of interesting live music. So I go to folk clubs, and I go to rock clubs, I go to jazz clubs, taking classical concerts. I really tried to keep on top of everything.
Let's listen to a song of yours that I really like. It's from one of your most popular albums, I guess, over the decades, from 1991. The album is Rumor and Sigh, and the song is I Feel So Good.
I feel so good, I'm gonna break somebody's heart tonight. I feel so good, I'm gonna take someone apart tonight. They put me in jail for my deviant ways. 2 years, 7 months, and 16 days. Going back on the street in a purple haze. I feel so good. I feel so good. Well, I feel so good. I'm gonna break somebody's heart tonight.
The character in that song is kind of a disturbing person. He appears to have been released from jail. Where did you get the idea for this character?
Well, you know, it's just fiction. I just started writing a story, you know, about, you know, someone with whom I would not have a lot of sympathy. And I suppose the reason you do that is to make people question their own morality. It poses the question, but doesn't give the answers. And I think sometimes, you know, dark characters are more interesting than happy ones. You know,
you sound so you really belt out the line of the chorus. I feel so good, and I'm just wondering if you have to be in some kind of strange character when you're singing that, because he's feeling good, but he's a pretty disturbing character.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, I think if you're a performer, there's a certain amount of theatre that goes into your performance. So if the song is written in the first person, you really do have to identify with the character and sing it as though you are that person. And also, as the writer, you have to pretty much do the same thing. So your intention is to be as convincing as possible. You know, this can be disturbing for the audience, I suppose. I don't know.
Richard Thompson plays two shows in Sacramento this week, tonight and tomorrow, both at the 24th Street Theater. Tomorrow night's show is an all-request concert, and I understand is already sold out, but I believe there are still tickets for the concert tonight. Over the years, you've written music for film and TV as well as regular recordings, and maybe the most prominent one, at least in recent years, was the soundtrack to the Werner Herzog documentary film Grizzly Man, about Timothy Treadwell, the man who lived among bears and was ultimately eaten by one of them. How did you get involved in that project?
That was really because I knew the producer of Grizzly Man. I was recommended to Werner to do the soundtrack, It was, you know, a great honor to work with Werner, whose films I'd admired for a long time, and it was really fun to be involved in that process. And I think the soundtrack was very successful. I mean, we did it pretty much improvised, just in a couple of days, which is, you know, that's pretty unusual for a film of that length.
And were you improvising having seen a final or close to final cut of the film, or were you basically working on just images and what Werner Herzog told you the film was like?
We were working mostly from images, so we would have a scene in mind. We didn't actually score it to picture. We weren't improvising while watching it. We watch it first and then go away and play, which is a slightly different process. And I think the idea of doing that was to make pieces of music that stood on their own merits, rather than pieces of music that only worked with the picture. you know, this is an unusual process, and perhaps we would never ever use that process again in scoring a film. But I think it worked for this particular project.
Let's listen to another clip of music by my guest Richard Thompson. This is a live recording from your album, The Chrono Show, in 2004, of the song "Did She Jump or Was She Pushed?" And if we take the lyrics literally, it starts off with a woman whose broken body is found after apparently falling off of a building.
She used to have style. She used to have style, and she used it. They say it turned bad when the truth came to call, and she refused it. She crossed a lot of people, some she called friends. Thought she'd live forever, but forever always ends. Did she jump or was she pushed? Did she jump or was she pushed?
Can you tell us where that song came from?
Well, again, you know, it's just a piece of fiction. You know, for me, it's very enjoyable to just sit down and write stories. I could probably say it's based on a couple of people that I knew. But really, you know, it's a kind of an ambiguous story, and you're supposed to make of it what you will.
Yes, yes. And it's such a haunting title. Did she jump or was she pushed?
Yeah, and it's supposed to mean, you know, not just the physical demise, but also, was she emotionally pushed or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Your concerts in Sacramento are solo. How often do you play now with bands?
It's something like every other year. Because it's expensive to tour with a band, it's something I can only really do when there's a project like a studio album to promote. So it tends to be something I can do every other year, but it's too expensive to take out all the time.
What do you prefer, going out on the road by yourself where it's completely on you, or with a band?
Well, it's really fun to do both. It's nice to have that contrast. It's nice to feel that I'm not locked into one particular musical realm. You know, that I can jump from one to the other. And obviously, playing with a band, there's more kind of camaraderie, and it's more about interplay. And playing solo, you really are on your own, and it's up to you. And I think playing solo is a real test of your musicality, really. You're very naked up there. You're very exposed, and I always feel a sense of achievement if I can stand on a stage solo and communicate with an audience.
We got time to listen to one more clip from your extensive recordings over the years. This is from your most recent album, Sweet Warrior, which came out in 2007, and this is called Sunset Song.
With you or without your love, I must be moving. I never meant to linger here so long. With you or without you, though, it breaks my heart to hear the sunset song. To hear the sunset song. Wasn't that a time we had? I bless you for. But I'm a stranger here, I don't belong.
The album Sweet Warrior seemed to be at least partly inspired by your own reaction to war.
Yeah, I think that's true. I see it as an album about conflict. It's about the conflict of war, or the conflict that you find in relationships or in politics. It seems to span all those fields.
Yeah. Do you have another album coming out that you're working on?
A couple, really. I'm working on another acoustic record and another band record. I think probably the band record is the one that's going to appear next, at some point next year. I have to get into the studio at the end of this year.
And then you might be touring with the band, I guess.
Hopefully next year, yes.
Yeah. Richard Thompson, the folk rock guitarist, singer, songwriter. He plays two shows in Sacramento this week, tonight and tomorrow, both at the 24th Street Theater. Tonight's show is a solo concert. Tomorrow night's show is an all-request concert, but is already sold out, we've been told. Richard Thompson, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more on our guests and topics, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver and Kelly Minnemeyer. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Insight, we have one goal.
That's an interesting. I've never been asked that question before.
Good.
Very good question.
That is such a good question.
To get the answers you want to hear.
That is such a great question.
That's a really good question.
From scientists, lawmakers, artists, interesting people of every stripe.
Well, you have really uncorked Pandora's box with that with that question.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.